Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're always delighted to be able to tap the intelligence, the considerable intelligence, of our first guest, Bill Walton, one of our regulars here, I'm pleased to say, at Secure Freedom Radio, the former master of the universe on Wall Street, now the host of the Bill Walton podcast television program, which is absolutely terrific, as well as a man of some considerable influence in conservative circles these days, former president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He is welcome here, as always. Bill, good to have you with us, sir.
Hello, Frank. Good talking with you.
I'm anxious to get your thoughts on a number of topics, Bill. Maybe starting with Ukraine. We're going to be talking more about the sort of geostrategic implications of what's developing there with our guest, Robert Charles, towards the end of the show. But one of the things that I think is squarely in your wheelhouse is this issue that the United States and its NATO allies, to varying degrees, perhaps, are threatening some very severe economic sanctions, including Russian access to something called the SWIFT system. If the Kremlin sends the massed forces across the border into Ukraine, what is the SWIFT system, Bill, and why is it potentially going to blow back on us should we actually take such a step with the Russians?
Well, the SWIFT system was created in the early 70s, I think 1973. And at that point, in post-World War II international trade, the amount of international bank cards and electronic transaction was growing and getting more complex. And the powers that be set up a nonprofit organization that brings about voluntary cooperation among international banks, and it's called the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication. And with a name like that, they quickly came up with SWIFT, which is what we call it. And it's been operating in a fairly effective way ever since its creation. And it's been great for facilitating international trade, but it also has become a weapon of choice for countries like the United States that necessarily don't want to commit armed forces. And we used it when we were imposing sanctions on Iran. And we've also threatened cutting Russia off from the SWIFT system. I think last time was the last Ukraine crisis about 8 or 9 years ago. So a country that's been cut out of the SWIFT system is seeing a debilitating impact on its ability to do business worldwide. Now, having said that, everybody knows how vulnerable they are to that, especially including Russia. And they've been working on a lot of alternatives to deal with being cut off from SWIFT, done a lot to modernize their banking system. They went through a banking crisis, and I think the number of banks in China went from something like 3,000 to 60 about 7 or 8 years ago. But I think they're more fully prepared to deal with this than in the past. And the other thing that we have to be mindful of is when this was set up, the United States was the dominant, preeminent world economy, and its currency was unassailable. Since then, the economy has become less ascendant. We're about the same size of China. And our ability to use the dollar as the world currency is under jeopardy because lots of countries, including China, not so much Russia, but a lot of other countries would like to see the dollar supplanted. And blowing up SWIFT like this might be just the opportunity for that to happen.
This is one of the things that I think we've got to be mindful of. We've got very serious interest on the part, as you say, Bill, of both the Russians and the Chinese and others, for that matter, taking down the dollar as the reserve currency. And they don't need much more encouragement. But this SWIFT play, overused as it is, might be just the ticket for the next ratcheting up.
Well, we have to be mindful of the Chinese interested in making common cause with the Russians. I mean, the Chinese economy is, what, 10 times larger than the Russian economy and has far more sophisticated information technology and artificial intelligence and currency apps than does Russia. And my fear is that China sees this as an opportunity to make common cause with Russia, and the United States finds itself a bit boxed in.
Let me ask you, Bill, speaking of China, about the supply chain problem. It's been acute. It's affected everything from computers to trucks, among other things. What do we know about the degree to which China, as part of its public health crisis, which I'm going to come back to in a minute, but is having an impact, will have an impact predictably on supply chains if major ports in China sustain long-term.
Well, we've all seen the supply chain bottlenecks affect the United States still 2 years, 3 years almost. We're moving into their third year in terms of the impact of lockdowns, and anybody walking into a grocery store in the United States sees what effect that's been having. But the world economy is beginning to recover. Shipping is beginning to recover. There's some return to normalcy, but the largest trading partner for most countries in the world is China, and China has a zero COVID policy and has proceeded to lock down city after city after city, port after port after port to deal with the Omicron, and they're particularly interested in the lockdown now because the Olympics are coming up in about 10 days and or 2 weeks, and they're going to be wanting to, you know, they don't want Omicron in the headlines. Or in reality, they don't want the infection. So they're beginning to shut things down. And when the Chinese shut their ports down, the rest of the world suffers accordingly.
The old line about when America sneezes, the rest of the world catches cold. It used to apply. It's now the, you know, reverse, I guess, with respect to China these days. We're catching a considerable cold. Let me ask you about what the implications of that might be for our economy, Bill Walton. I mean, this is your wheelhouse. The ripple effects of supply chain disruptions for inflation and for consumer demand and for, well, you know, our own production here in the United States. I mentioned trucks as an example. If they don't have chips, things get really blocked up. What are you expecting out of this lockdown taking place, for example, in the world's busiest seaport, Ningbo, I think it's called, in China, for the U.S. economy and inflation and the rest?
Well, the optimistic part of me, and I know we've talked
about
it.
It's not encouraged here, Bill.
It's not encouraged on this show, but nevertheless, I think China is window dressing everything leading up to these Winter Olympics, and their entire focus is what the world's going to be thinking about China beginning February 4th when the Olympics open. And so they've cracked down dramatically because of the Omicron. My guess is that once the Olympics are over, that crackdown's going to end. And I think we'll see a lot of these bottlenecks open up again. I mean, China cannot afford to shut down. China's growth has been slowing dramatically. I think I mentioned last week, if the fourth quarter growth was 4%, and a lot of us think it wasn't even that good. And Xi's under tremendous political pressure to keep the economic plate spinning. You know, we talked also about the fact he went to Davos and started jawboning the global bankers to keep interest rates low because he's got to keep his economy going. He knows he can't afford to keep things shut down. And with the UK beginning to lift, I think, every single one of its Omicron restrictions and other countries and companies doing the same thing, my guess is within a month, China's going to let up and we're going to start seeing a return to normal.
Well, from your lips to God's
ears. If there ever will be normal again, I'm not sure what normal looks like.
The new normal, as they say. Hey, speaking of new normal, Bill, there is talk out of the Federal Reserve of adopting a central bank digital currency in the future. At this point, it is the subject of a report that they've issued rather than an actual direction to begin doing that. But is that in the offing, do you think? And what are the implications of it?
Well, I'm sure it's in the offing. You know, China's announced its plans to launch a digital currency. Most major European countries, or the EU anyways, thinking about doing that. And now Russia has announced its plans to create a digital ruble. And so we're unlikely to not want to participate in that new currency game. Now, the issue with the digital currency is it requires record keeping about who owns it and provides a lot of opportunities for people to monitor transactions, even much more so than does the SWIFT system, which we talked about earlier. And so the privacy issues with the digital currency are huge. We haven't really thought that through. I think if we do it, and I think the Fed has written a paper on it, and I'm not sure, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but my guess is they're trying to get ahead of this digital game. And where this goes could be exciting and could be very damaging for the United States status and in its world currency role.
One of the particular concerns I have, I must tell you, is that the digital currency plays brilliantly into this whole effort to impose a sort of social credit system, which seems to be one of the upshots, in prospect at least, of the vaccine mandates enforcement mechanism, namely these so-called vaccine passports. And you start compiling and being able to, you know, mine or otherwise monitor at least the digital footprints of, or fingerprints, if you will, of every American. It's a very short step, if there is a digital currency, to being able to essentially manipulate as well access to money and the use thereof. It's really chilling and you know, sort of Orwellian in spades. Let me ask you, Bill, about one other thing, if I may. There is a new book out. I've not had a chance to read it. I imagine you haven't either. Mark Levin got a sneak peek at it and had a great conversation with its author, Peter Schweitzer, last night on his Fox News program. It's entitled Red Hands, and it talks about essentially how the Chinese Communist Party has used corruption to secure incredible access to and influence over a number of politicians of both parties, let the record show, and the corporate America as well. Again, I imagine you haven't had a chance to see it. I don't know if you caught Mark's program and interview, but it was really well done, as is, well, all of Peter's body of work, but this one seems to be particularly timely and intensively researched in a way that I think we hope to have a chance to talk with him about it ourselves here, of course, but to share with everyone else the principal insights of it, which is that what we warn about a lot in our Committee on the Present Danger of China, namely the penetration and subversion of this country by the Chinese Communist Party, is really far advanced, according to this book.
Well, what the Chinese, I haven't read his book. I admire what Peter's general work is about, and I'm sure he's onto something and has some great stories. But it amplifies one of the real geniuses of Chinese strategic strategy, global strategy to push China into the catbird seat in the world. And what they do very well is they make all the strategic issues for them personal. And they've been extraordinarily effective at infiltrating universities, Congress, corporations, Silicon Valley, you name it. And they don't go at it in a corporate way. They go at it in a personal way. And they find people who they think are vulnerable because of whatever their needs are, whether you're a researcher that needs capital to fund something, or whether you're a company that wants access to the Chinese market so that you can, increase your revenue there, or, you know, the list goes on. And so the Chinese, over the last 15, 20 years, has accumulated hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of chits that where people owe something to the Chinese, or the Chinese have something on them, because Chinese surveillance system, which extends well beyond its own borders and into this country as well as most of the rest of the West, gives them a lot of personal data. And, you know, we've seen the President Xi's crackdown on Chinese technology companies in the last year. And there are two things driving that. One, he thinks the Chinese tech companies have become frivolous, too consumer-oriented, games and ride-sharing and things like that. Then he wants to be more in strategic industries like semiconductors and artificial intelligence. But the other thing, is, and that bears on this, they want to have control over all that data. They want all the personal data that they gather through the technology companies, and even not wanting companies from, you know, Chinese-based companies listing in New York is saying now, we don't want anybody else access to all this personal data, because they know they can use that to bring about their ends.
Interestingly enough, the Chinese Communist Party is applying precisely that principle to our own Olympic athletes, among others, who will all be monitored not only through the various other means of, you know, the Chinese surveillance state, but apparently through apps that they must download and utilize, which apparently will give them the Chinese, that is, considerable access to the personal.
Well, they have an app. They have an app that they're using, Frank, and they're requiring everybody coming in to the Olympic Village to have this app on their phone. And ostensibly, it's to monitor whether or not people have the virus. But what it really does is it allows them to gather an incredible amount of information. And the app allows sensors and hardware that the app uses to take control of your camera and your microphone. And again, this is not an optional app that you can download just to find other people in Olympic Village. This is mandatory, and it means everybody with that app will be subject to incredible invasion of their personal privacy.
And Bill, I'm afraid that's only just a taste of what the Chinese are going to be doing. I think a DNA collection and other personal health information is also going to be exploited against these athletes, certainly to the benefit of the Chinese in their biological warfare program, perhaps, or maybe just their efforts to build superhuman figures of war, super warriors, for that matter. It's really chilling, and the idea that we're doing this against the backdrop of genocide is just unbelievably scandalous.
We shouldn't be going to China for the Winter Olympics, and we should not send our athletes there.
Well said, and a topic we'll return to momentarily with Gordon Chang. Thank you, Bill Walton, for all you do. It's great to have a chance to visit with you each week, and thank you for kicking ours off this one. Talk to you soon. Next up, as I said, Gordon Chang, and we'll get into the Olympics and much more.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is always a delight to be able to say, one of the highlights of my week, for that matter, that Gordon Chang is in the house virtually. He is, of course, one of our country's preeminent experts on the Chinese Communist Party and what it is up to and its implications for the region, but also for us. He's the author of a number of really important books, including The Coming Collapse of China. He is an essayist of great productivity and renown, including these days at the Gatestone Institute, where he is a senior fellow. He is also a columnist for Newsweek, and you can find him in The Hill and elsewhere. He is, among other things, a go-to guy you must follow at Gordon G. Chang, as do I. Gordon, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
In the previous segment, we talked a bit with Bill Walton about the Olympics and what is going on there that argues for our athletes not going there. And I wanted to take stock with you, Gordon, as a man who's following closely, I know, the public health crisis in China, the various indicators that the Chinese are using their apps and the like to monitor, surveil, collect, and otherwise presumably compromise our athletes and the like. What's your take on the latest in this regard?
The overall context is that China's committing genocide and crimes against humanity And although one can sympathize with athletes because they do want to compete, nonetheless, it is wrong to hold the Olympics in such a country. But when we talk about the latest, of course, there's the coronavirus epidemic, which China cannot control. It is in Beijing, Omicron, and the athletes have to go through extraordinarily draconian measures, which are really inconsistent with an athletic competition. I mean, the situation is so bad, as NBC has reported, that it's not even sending its own announcers to Beijing. They will be in NBC's facility in Connecticut. But also, there are other concerns that we have talked about past, and that is, of course, that China will be getting the DNA of these athletes. It will certainly be using it in its biological weapons program. We know that Chinese athletes haven't been safe. There's Peng Shui, the three-time Olympian, who is now under effectively house arrest in Beijing. This is a question of the safety of the athletes. And this should be foremost in the minds of the International Olympic Committee as the test that I think says that, despite everything else, Frank, this test says that we shouldn't be holding an Olympics in Beijing. As everyone has pointed out, the IOC delayed the 2020 Summer Olympics, which were intended to be held in Tokyo. They were delayed a year, eventually held in Japan. But the point is, the IOC applying the same standard should be delaying the Beijing Olympics.
And Gordon, do you think it's fair to say that the reason that the IOC is not doing that is that they are either so compromised themselves or so fearful of retribution by China that they wouldn't contemplate taking a step that otherwise it would seem would be absolutely necessary?
Yeah, of course, we're not in the heads of the IOC, but nonetheless, that would appear to be the case because those are the only explanations that make sense. Also, the IOC has got a Winter Olympics problem in that nobody really wants them. There were only two bidders for these games, Almaty in Kazakhstan and Beijing in China. And so the IOC is, if it wants to hold the games, has got to do something because the conditions under which it is forcing countries to accept Olympics are just unacceptable. So they create the conditions under which they are almost forced to take a Chinese bid. But of course, for all the reasons we talked about, including most importantly, the genocide, this is just wrong. It is morally wrong. It is wrong from the IOC's own standards. This is just offensive and disgusting.
It really is. And dangerous, I think, is the point. And, you know, Gordon, I was thinking back this morning to the super spreader event that took place, as you know, the notorious Wuhan potluck dinner in the middle of the initial stages of this COVID breakout in Wuhan that conduced, I think there's no question about it, to spreading the disease worldwide when the Chinese refused to allow people to move about inside China from Wuhan, but they were free to travel all over the world and did. This has the potential, this genocide games exercise, to be potentially even a greater super spreader event, seems to me. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that dinner that you talk about was in January of 2020. It was on the eve of the Lunar New Year holiday in China, which is generally 6 to 7 days, but which effectively is a much longer and bigger event, like 2 week holiday. And so what we have is the Olympics really occurring during the Lunar New Year holiday. Even if it were occurring at some other time of the year, you have people from all over the world convening in a place where there's an outbreak of Omicron. And also Delta is also, I think, in Beijing, but certainly is through the rest of China. So yes, there is the potential for this being a global super spreader event.
Gordon, this comes at a time when, in addition to the ongoing genocide against the Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities, which Josh Rogan has suggested makes this holding of the games at this moment with the support of not just the IOC, but all of the nations participating, an exercise in, according to Josh, genocide denial. Seems to me to be a pretty apt term. We are also seeing China flexing its muscles yet again against Taiwan, clearly no accident that they've sent flights of 30-plus aircraft into Taiwan airspace over the weekend. Doesn't this make pretty clear their intention to act once the games are behind them with even more aggressiveness?
Yeah, the concern here is that as Russia pressures Ukraine, that China will take this as an opportunity to do something aggressive. There are a number of people who actually believe that China will invade this year after the Olympics. I'm not so sure that that's the case for a number of reasons. This gets to be very complex. But nonetheless, this is a time of heightened tension. The problem, and it's a general one, is that there is a failure of American deterrence of China, and that's in general. It, of course, was aggravated because of the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, but it was clear even in March of last year when China sent its top two diplomats to Anchorage that China did not feel that it had to be concerned about the United States. So this is a general problem, and whether it involves an invasion this year, I don't know. But the point is that this is a general lack of failure of deterrence. And when that happens, deterrence can fail everywhere. And we've seen this. We've seen this in periods where you make a mistake in one place and problems occur everywhere else. Also, the reverse is true, that when the United States is strong and is able to achieve its objectives in one location, peace breaks out around the world. So this is really a test of the Biden administration.
Gordon, this brings me to this question of the sort of probability that bad guys will act in concert, either by prearrangement or opportunistically, if, say, Russia goes into Ukraine or China goes into Taiwan or India, for that matter, or perhaps both. This is heightened by the exercises, the naval exercises that are taking place, I think, at the moment or shortly, in the North Indian Ocean, involving Chinese assets, Russian warships, and those of Iran as well. What do you make of this show of force, if you will, this axis that seems to be developing, and their willingness to be seen as jointly collaborating in the military space?
Russia, China, and Iran, their navies exercised in the northern Indian Ocean on Friday, the 21st. They've done this before, I think going back to something like 2019, but this clearly shows that there is an axis forming, and it's not just Russia and China, it's their proxies. So you've got Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, maybe even Algeria. So this shows that there is a growing working together of these groups, which are no longer afraid of the U.S., and we've seen this because there's been blatant violation of both U.S. and U.N. sanctions on both the two proxies, the North Korea and Iran. The Biden administration is struggling to catch up, and so far it's not been able to do so.
Yeah. Speaking of North Korea, Gordon, the clock is now running on what's left of the Moon Jae-in regime in South Korea. And one of its idéfixes is this notion that it will enshrine President Moon's legacy as a peacemaker by engineering an end-of-war agreement with the North Koreans and the United States. What are we looking for in terms of progress in that direction? Worrying progress, if you will, but nonetheless evidence that it's afoot.
Fighting in the Korean War ended with an armistice in July 1953, not with a peace treaty. So technically, the war still continues. And the Moon administration does want an end of war declaration, which is not even an armistice. And although a number of countries have said that they are generally in favor of it, including the United States, still there is not very much progress on a actual document itself. And the reason is that it's a truly atrocious idea. Everyone is concerned about how this would affect stability. Stability is maintained on the Korean Peninsula by the presence of 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea and the U.S.-South Korea military alliance. And in any end of war declaration or anything else, really, it has no effect except perhaps to undermine the alliance. And as long as we keep the alliance in place, as long as we keep troops there, that is what is going to maintain the stability in North Asia. And without that, clearly the North would engage in extreme provocations and maybe even invasion of the South.
Do you see any indication, Gordon, that this will eventuate in the next month or so? I don't know the exact timing of the end of Moon's term, but I know it's at hand. And it's a question of, well, whether his successor is going to be equally committed to this or not. But assuming that's not the case, what are your crystal ball predictions as to how this is going to work out?
My crystal ball prediction is that common sense prevails. Although the Biden administration has publicly said that it is willing to consider an end of war declaration and has actually said some things in favor of it, there doesn't seem to be any real willingness to sign it. China has been very much in favor of an end of war declaration in its public statements, although some people do question whether they really do intend to push it. The only party that is really fervently supporting it is President Moon, whose term ends in May of this year, but effectively his term ends on March 9th, which is the presidential election. North Korea has been basically noncommittal, but is probably never going to sign such a document for various reasons. So I think my sense is that, as I said, that countries will realize that this is not a good idea, but you never know. You never, never know, because there's a lot of virtue signaling that this current administration in Washington does. I trust that they have good sense, but we'll just have to wait for some time to see.
Well, and they've been apparently indicating, according to the South Korean foreign minister, that they have agreed in principle to it. So it's a matter of do they decide to move forward on it during this window, particularly with Moon in office and pressures building, perhaps, to try to prevent a North Korean dimension to the coming potential conflict involving a bunch of other nations as well. Stay tuned, as they say, Gordon Chang. Let me just ask you about one other thing, if I may, Gordon. We talked earlier in the program with Bill Walton about the supply chain crisis that we've been experiencing of late, becoming even worse as the Chinese public health crisis is involving the lockdown of some of its key ports. How do you see that playing into our own economic situation as well as stability inside China itself?
The accelerating COVID outbreaks across China are resulting in these supply chain disruptions, which are severe. At the last week, there were about 120 ships off the twin ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. In China, last half of last year, there's an average of about 300 ships waiting. In the early part of November, the number actually went to 493 ships were waiting to load. We know that air freight rates have spiked 50% in the last couple of weeks as shippers decide that they absolutely need to move goods and can't get them across the sea. So they're now starting to use air cargo. This will continue for quite some time because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's just the Olympics. After that, China will loosen up its COVID restrictions. Well, no, it won't, because then you've got March 4th and 5th, the National People's Congress meeting and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. You've got the 20th National Congress of the Communist Party at the end of the year. There's so many dates this year that would, I think, convince China to keep its zero COVID policy, which is causing these problems. This is contributing to inflation in the United States. You just can't get goods. There's all sorts of adverse knock-on effects for us. We really do need to bring our supply chains back home. And by the way, there's been 140 American legislators who've urging the Biden administration to give more exclusions to this tariffs that the Trump administration imposed on China. That's a really bad idea right now, because those tariffs are starting to get companies to move their supply chains to this side of the Pacific.
Which we definitely want them to do, needless to say. Gordon, just one last question on all of that. Is there a danger for the party Congress and other considerations for Xi that the economy of China is going to be further impacted if these ports are frozen and the supply chains are disrupted?
The economy has already been undermined by these draconian lockdowns. Also, one other factor, and that is the debt crisis. The debt crisis is already starting to affect Chinese companies' ability to produce because factories mortgage their facilities. And when the value of those facilities go down, their working capital goes down. But a debt crisis could really be quite severe because China can't ship what it doesn't produce. And this is something else that could actually be a killer on the supply chains. I mean, right now things are coming slowly, but maybe they'll not come at all if this debt crisis matures. As it will at some point, maybe not this year, but it has to mature. There's too much debt in China.
Gordon, fascinating stuff. As always, we appreciate your expertise and your willingness to share it with us each week. We look forward to doing so again next week. Thank you for your time today. God bless you, my friend, and stay well. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles. We'll take stock, among other things, on why China is hoarding food and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're back with a man who I consider to be one of our favorite regulars. His name is Robert Charles. He has served his country in a number of important capacities, most recently during the George W. Bush administration as an Assistant Secretary of State. He has, however, also been Naval Intelligence Officer, a Congressional Counsel in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, and, among other things, is these days a spokesman for a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, better known as AMAC, and you can follow his writings there at amac.us. Bobby, I just have to say I had a wonderful visit with the AMAC team last week in their podcast, and a chance to really appreciate so much the kinds of educational efforts you're making with the mature American citizens, as you call them, 2.4 million of them, and what a force for good it is. It's really a pleasure to have talked with Rebecca Weber and always, of course, to have the chance to visit with you here. So thanks for all you do at AMAC, among other things.
Well, thank you, Frank. And I have to tell you, between people like you and people like America Has a Future That Is Bright, but it is only, I think, because of the kind of convictions that you find about among those 2.4 million and the convictions you bring to the microphone every day that we're there. And we're always reminded. I know you and I have used the quote before because it's such a touchstone, but freedom doesn't get passed down, as we said, through the genetics. It gets passed down by the only way to do it.
Yes. And that's what we're all about here. Bobby, let me ask you, speaking of some of these challenges to our freedoms, the existential threats of which the old boss Ronald Reagan spoke. China is buying up American farmland, and you have an important piece about this at amac.us. I touched on it with Gordon Chang a moment ago, but give us your sense of what's afoot there and its implications.
Yeah, I mean, I recognize that, and I'll spare people a lot of the data right now. And you can go to amac.us and see that article, which has a lot of data in it. I recognize that the more immediate concerns with respect to China are Taiwan, ICBM deployment, space, all kinds of other things, Wuhan virus. But the reality is that every once in a while, you have to look at the horizon and see if you have something getting larger on the horizon that could become a real problem. And that Western reliance right on China, which we really did not pay attention to this for things like pharmaceuticals, is huge. I mean, literally, I won't name the pharmaceuticals, but there's a tremendous degree of almost being held captive commercially to the Chinese in some key areas, key commercial areas, key rare earths. The problem with farmland, and so what they're doing is China is moving all around the world. It's not just here. They've had a roughly tenfold increase in 10 years. in the acquisition of the most, not just arable, but the most productive farmland in the world. And what are they doing? Including, by the way, buying up major name brands in the United States and chunks of the Midwest. So, it's only at maybe 2% now, Chinese ownership, but it's on a trajectory to grow. And the point is that when we, for example, had there was an attack, a cyber attack on meat production plants around the United States and feeding the foreign countries, China actually asserted its right to take pork and meat that was produced here in the United States and to send it to China. So while we did not have it, they did have it. And the reason was that they owned, you can challenge that legally, but they owned that farmland and they owned that production and they owned that pork and they used it for their people, not for us. And so, you know, a national gradually grows when you have dependence, not just for pharmaceuticals and not just in all the other things. You know that we've become much too close to that communist country, but we now end up having to worry about whether they control a larger and larger percentage of food production.
And what do you say, Robert, to people who would argue, well, it's our farmland, it's our country, it's our pork, it's our production capacity. Even if they own it in time of need, we can simply expropriate.
The answer to that is yes, we can. But I will tell you that it's a two-pronged phenomenon. The first is that they are buying up food production capacity around the globe. It's not just in the United States. And they are looking, you know, whether you call it an oligopoly eventually or a monopoly, they're trying to corner as much as they can that market the way they have other markets. And I don't think, you know, we're not talking a country that doesn't have a track record. And of course, even if they don't make us dependent, but they make our allies, where we can't transship enough or produce enough to feed all of our allies, you have a problem. And yes, you're right, expropriation. But, you know, it's also true that the more that China finds a way to integrate itself into our commercial world and take things over, as you know, whether it's in the stock market or it's high tech, or it's university high research, or it's farmland, the less we have immediate, you know, control over it. So yes, we could expropriate under the National Security Act in a time of need. But I think if we ever get to that point, it's really an indicator is what I'm pointing to. I'm pointing to the fact that China has a strategic intent to try to monopolize global food production if they can get there.
And I think implicit, at least in what you said, Bobby, is that you cannot exercise the full control that theoretically you have if you have officials in our government deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and business leaders and others who will be part of a China lobby saying, oh, don't expropriate their stuff because they'll take what we have over there in China, for example. And you can bet that will happen. In fact, there's a new book. I haven't had a chance to see it or read it yet myself, but Mark Levin, as I mentioned earlier in the program, had a great interview with Peter Schweitzer about it. I don't know if you caught it, Bobby, but it's entitled Red Hands, and it's a very, very ominous report on the extent to which the penetration and subversion by the Chinese communists of our elites, elite capture is their term for it, is very far advanced and would have bearing on our ability, our policymakers' willingness, shall we say, to act in these manners if even, God forbid, we get into this kind of critical state where we need that food ourselves. Bobby, let me turn to another critical state. You were on Fox and Friends this morning, I believe, talking about Ukraine. What is in prospect now in terms of a conflict there involving not just perhaps Russia and Ukraine, but NATO or Europe more generally, and even us? Talk about your thoughts about that, if you would.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Frank. This is a cascading or potentially very dangerous domino kind of a, and I think that's really here. You know, I used an analogy, which I will use again because I think it's very timely. In September of 1938, a very weak Western leader, Neville Chamberlain, who would die within 6 months, who was perceived as weak. Went over pre-war, and even though Germany had built itself out to be ready for war, and people were concerned. He went over and signed an accord, the Munich Accords, which were intended to allow, in a peaceable way, if such a thing, the German-speaking Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, to become part of Germany, and kind of a sign-off that this was kind of going to be, well, what he landed on back on British soil and said, peace for our time. Of course, an act of profound appeasement of a profoundly evil fascist empire. And most people, including Winston Churchill, who saw this happen, were aghast. But that having been said, what are we looking at right now? Using some of the very same reasoning that was used to justify the Munich Accords, we see a Russian, overbearing Russian autocracy leaning in on Ukraine with the idea that they want to take Russian-speaking portion of Ukraine. Why? Because there's an affinity of the people. Many of the people want that. They historically have the same kind of arguments that Germany used about the Sudetenland. And what happened? Joe Biden basically green-lighted this by saying, well, a minor incursion wouldn't matter. And then he tried to retreat. But that tells you everything you need to know about the National Security Council. So the concern here is that Russia, this is almost, the time for deterrence is over and gone. That was months and months ago. This is no longer, we're no longer, you see all this talk of deterrence. Russia has 175,000 troops on that border. They've reoriented their commercial rail structure to bring materiel and troops to that border. They also, by the way, are simultaneously pushing up against through Belarus. They're pushing up against Poland, which has closed their border, Lithuania. So what should we do? Of course, we should.
Not least Ukraine itself, in close proximity to the capital of Kiev.
That's right. So they're pushing from the east against the west of Ukraine, but they're also pushing down through. They could easily come down through Belarus, which is the last border. Bottom line here is this: if Russia does something significant, and should we put American troops, more of them, in maybe Poland and Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia? Of course, those are NATO countries. Ukraine is not a NATO country. However, if Russia moves on Ukraine, a whole series of dominoes begin to fall in a direction that they have not fallen before. And the first is that we are then instantly challenged. All the credibility of the United States and NATO is challenged in terms of how they react. And Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. So I don't think throwing out massive sanctions, so-called, is going to really burden anyone. It's got to be much bigger than that. I mean, maybe you reverse Nord Stream 2. Maybe you... there's a whole series of things that could potentially happen, but I don't hear any of it specifically discussed. And then China, because they're watching this like a hawk, and they're going to say, wow, lots of puff, lots of smoke and mirrors, and everybody's distracted by Ukraine now. I think we may just take the Spratly Islands. Maybe we'll challenge Taiwan by taking, you know, or maybe we'll take the Sakhalin Islands, or maybe we'll, I mean, they just flew 39 fighter jets into Taiwan base within the last several days. Maybe we'll just intimidate them into the position that we've always thought that they should have. And we think the Biden administration won't do crap. And so I'm sorry, but the bottom line here is this is a huge challenge to American credibility. It'll ricochet across the Middle East. It'll ricochet into this hemisphere. It'll ricochet across the Far East. And it was a complete mismanagement following speaking no, nothing for the extension of the START Treaty, allowing Nord Stream 2 to go forward, debacle in Afghanistan. It's pretty clear to Putin what he sees every day on his desk is, this is our moment. This might be the best time in a century to go grab. China's going to feel the same way.
Bobby, I think what you're saying about the possibilities that other nations will pile on in the event something cooks off, whether it's starting with Ukraine or whether it's starting with Taiwan or some other spot, it does seem to me we're at the cusp of a very, very significant, if not a truly global conflict. Bobby, this brings me to something that you wrote about, again, as I recall, also at AMAC, about our old boss, Ronald Reagan, and his first speech. Remind us of that speech and some of its resonance in our own time.
It's remarkable, Frank, and it was really an accident. I was going back through some of the books of speeches that Reagan had given, and I realized this pivotal, really iconic speech that was given in 1964, A Time for Choosing. What's fascinating is if you pull just a little bit, you pull at the string, he talks a lot about communism and its potential devastating effect on freedom around the world. Not least because if you allow it to progress without reacting to it directly, it will continue to consume all the oxygen until freedom is gone. And of course, he was referring at that time boldly to the Soviet Union. He really mapped out how we needed to choose in order to subvert and eventually avert that threat. But you can see in all of his words exactly what China is doing right now. So yes, the Soviet Union came to their knees, but the reality is that the Chinese are rising, and so his speech is so apt for addressing the Chinese issue. It's also apt at home because he's very blunt about the fact that. It's unbelievable. You read the speech and you almost think it was written yesterday because he talked, the right wing will be vilified by socialists. They will not want a conversation to occur. They will shut down the conversations. He doesn't use cancel culture word, but the gist is the First Amendment, the amendment all think of as dear are going to be challenged directly by the left. And, he and of course the great conservative thinker, Russell Kirk, we're very much on to this in the 50s and the 60s. But you read that speech, and I encourage people to read the piece at amac.us or read the speech itself, and you just are stunned because what Reagan did was he looked ahead and said, there's going to be a moment, and he thought he was in one then, but this moment right now, when we are challenged from within and from abroad by forces that could take us down. And he wanted everybody to understand you have to stand up when someone's coming at you like that.
Again, peace through strength, as we've been talking about throughout the program. And in this case, Bobby, I think what is so instructive is that the Soviet Union didn't just come to its knees, as you put it. It was taken down by Reagan, who, as president, acted on a strategy to accomplish just what he said he was going to do in the time for choosing remarks. And what the Chinese took away from that was particularly the dangers if they were not really intimately integrated into the West, that a similar kind of play could be used against them, namely cutting off their cash flow. And this has been one of the things that we've been trying to address in the context of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and its work. And I commend all of our listeners some fantastically interesting championing of ways to do to the Chinese Communist Party what Reagan did to the Soviet Communist Party, namely cutting off its cash flow despite the penetration, despite what they've done, documented now by Peter Schweitzer, among others, to make it hard. But there are things we can do. We have a Mad as Hell campaign that we have put together to try to begin to equip people to realize that it's your money that is being used in a lot of different ways by the Chinese to build this threat to us, and it must be cut off, and we can do that, we believe. We must leave it there. Robert Charles, thank you for your insights on all of these topics, your great clarity on what should be done and the stakes if we fail to do so, both here and, of course, in your other output at amac.us and elsewhere. I know you'll keep up the good work and look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.